Some audio from Howard Storm's near-death experience. Foreword. From the moment I glimpsed Howard Storm on television, I knew he was extraordinary even among the near-deathers, those unique individuals who, as the result of medical catastrophe, have been to the other side. Yes, he'd seen the light they all talk about, E3/4. Yes, he'd experienced the personal life review so many mention, E3/4. Yes, he'd experienced the warmth and love of a higher being. But there was infinitely more to it for this man, who, as if that hadn't been enough. And he'd returned from death to alter the entire course of his life. A career as an artist and teacher of art had been left behind for the Christian ministry, and it was obvious that Howard Storm's compulsion to talk about what had happened to him was ongoing. He was driven the way the saints of old were driven. He had been thrown down on the road to Damascus, and in each subsequent television appearance in which I saw him and there were many, he appeared to be in the process of climbing to his feet from that fall, struggling to testify to the momentous implications of what he'd seen. I wanted to find him, know him, beg him for more details. Only a deep inveterate respect for his privacy kept me from seeking him out. When I finally discovered that he could and would write about his experiences, I was desperate for the material. And my expectations have been overwhelmingly surpassed. This book you have in hand is his most complete testimony to date. The story is beyond remarkable. Hell and heaven are realized in these pages. The Lord himself and his angels are encountered. Storm sees the universe beyond time. Sure, others have told this story. That's the way it works. There are witnesses in all times and in many different places. Storm is a vital and enduring witness for here and for now. With a rare combination of sophistication and humility, Storm is able to lead us into a place of harrowing darkness, and through his delivery from it by means of a simple if not primitive prayer, a realm of beatific light is revealed in all its splendor, and we are taken with Storm beyond time and doubt and care to the very secrets of the universe before the inevitable and painful return. Make no mistake, this man's a mystic. This is a book that fulfills a calling. This is a book you devour from cover to cover, and pass on to others. This is a book you will quote in your daily conversation. Storm was meant to write it, and we were meant to read it. Each near-death experience changes the one who survives it. That one inevitably touches countless others. Storm's vocation is that he is meant to touch a great multitude. E3/4, the loaves and fishes given to him will feed thousands, if not hundreds of thousands. Such is his gift, and the gift to us. A. Ann Rice, New Orleans, January 2005. Paris, the City of Light. What could possibly go wrong in the heart of the civilized world? This was to be the next to last day of our art tour of Europe. Saturday morning began with a visit to Eugène Delacroix's home and studio. The studio contained Delacroix's palette, his easel, the chair he sat in, and his writing desk. Just my wife Beverly and I went to his studio because everyone else in the group wanted to sleep late, as they were getting pretty tired of being dragged around museums and galleries from morning till night. We arrived at the Delacroix Museum at 9, and just before 11 o'clock we returned to our hotel room to get our little group ready to go to the Georges Pompidou Center of Modern Art. This was to be one of the high points of the tour of Europe. Back in the hotel room there was a feeling of nausea rising up inside me. A few times on our trip I had had indigestion and taken some over-the-counter antacid and aspirin tablets, which always alleviated the discomfort. Now I took two aspirin and washed them down with some stale coke from the evening before and continued talking to one of the students, trying to ignore the growing discomfort in my stomach. As I was talking to my student Monica about the day's plan, I felt as though I'd been shot. There was a searing pain in the middle of my stomach. My knees collapsed and I sank to the floor. I held my gut and screamed with pain. Something terrifying was happening inside me, and I didn't know what it was. I was surprised that there was no wound on the outside of my body. In fact, there had been no sound, and as I glanced about, there was no way a bullet could have entered the room. I looked up at the windows that opened onto the balcony, Morning sunlight was streaming through the closed glass of the balcony doors, filtered through the sheer curtains. There was no broken glass where I expected to see a bullet hole in the window, no ripped hole in the pristine curtain. There was only a wound deep inside my abdomen. The pain was drowning me, like I was sinking into a lava pool of agony. As I thrashed about on the floor in desperate confusion, I searched feverishly for some explanation of what was happening to me. One minute I was talking with Monica about our upcoming museum visit and the next I was writhing on the floor, consumed with pain. I had collapsed at the foot of the bed but had wriggled my way into the narrow space between the wall and the bed. In terror, I struggled into a space where I would be safely wedged into a fetal position. Constricted between the bed and the wall, I struggled to control my rising panic. By screaming and groaning, I knew I was adding to my predicament and making it impossible for my wife to understand what was happening to me. I screamed for my wife Beverly to get a doctor. She was numb with shock. I cursed at her when she didn't respond. She composed herself enough to call the hotel desk and was told that a doctor would be summoned immediately. From the floor I looked up at the full-length windows in the French doors to the balcony. Through the transparent white curtains, light was flooding into the little hotel room, and outside the sky was a brilliant cerulean blue. Somehow I felt reassured by the beauty of the day. Something was very wrong with me, but I took comfort in the fact that a doctor was on the way. This was Paris, the city of light. I would be okay. As I waited, the pain kept getting worse. I tried to be stoic. I fought to control the gnawing terror. In 10 minutes the doctor arrived. He was slightly built and in his early 30s. I could resist only feebly as he struggled to pull me up onto the bed. He asked me what had happened as he opened the buttons of my shirt to examine my stomach. His probing fingers on my abdomen aggravated the pain. I fought against him. He said I had a perforation in my duodenum. I must go to a hospital right away. Will I need an operation? I asked. Yes, immediately he said. He phoned for an ambulance and then gave me a small amount of morphine by injection. The intense agony began to subside. He explained that the morphine was just enough to get me to the hospital, but wouldn't interfere with the anesthetic of the surgery that I would be having very soon. It became possible to think more clearly. The hospital stay would be most inconvenient. Tomorrow my wife and I with the students on the tour supposed to drive to Amsterdam for the return flight to America. But things would work out. I could manage. I always had. The two young men who arrived with the ambulance appeared to be very pleasant. They lifted me from the bed and supported me on either side, carrying my weight on their shoulders. We went down the hall and into a tiny hotel elevator that took us down to the first floor. There was barely enough room for us in the little elevator as I was propped up between them. The elevator stopped at the first floor, one floor above the street. From there, a long, winding staircase led down to street level. The ambulance attendants found a straight back chair from the hotel dining room and carried me down the stairs. The men were straining to keep me aloft and balanced. I teetered and tottered as they struggled to carry me. I kept murmuring, "Please don't drop me." They laid me on a gurney at the sidewalk and then slid me into the back of a little ambulance. For a moment I panicked because I was afraid we were going to leave without my wife. To my great relief, I saw Beverly climb in the front seat beside the driver. The ambulance careened wildly through the Paris streets with its distinctive siren clearing a path through heavy midday traffic. I was reminded of scenes from World War II movies by the siren sound, wailing mournfully through the congested streets of Paris. After an amazing ride traveling at high speed, with the little ambulance swaying dangerously around each corner, we arrived at the emergency room of a large public hospital in Paris. I was immediately met by two young female doctors who began a thorough examination. One of the doctors looked like a young Jeanne Moreau. The other was thin and pale, with the saddest eyes. The intimacy of the examination they were doing was embarrassing. After consulting the X-ray films, they told me I had a large hole in my duodenum due to unknown causes, maybe an ulcer, maybe a foreign object. I must have an operation immediately or I would die. I asked if this could be done in America and was told I wouldn't survive the trip. They assured me that this was the best and biggest hospital in Paris. They were completely convincing as to the urgency of the situation and the necessity of the surgery. They needed to get a tube into my stomach, but failed to tell me about the procedure. A big man straddled me and began to force a large aquarium-type tube down my nose. It slammed against the back of my throat, forcing a gag reaction. The more I gagged, the harder he shoved. Through the tears filling my eyes, I saw the thin doctor with the sad, compassionate eyes make swallowing gestures with her hands, and I swallowed as hard as I could and the tube slid down. I was still feeling the pain, but the morphine had taken the madness out of the terror. It was manageable now. As part of my effort to stay in control, I forced some weak laughter and made lame attempts at jokes. I was scared. I told my dear Beverly it would be okay. The doctors talked about a hospital stay of 3 or 4 weeks. Then there would be a couple of months of recovery at home. Following the examination in the emergency department, I was taken by gurney out of the emergency building and rushed several blocks to the hospital building where the surgery would be performed. Every time the wheels banged against an imperfection in the concrete sidewalk, pain shot through my stomach, but I was comforted by the beauty of the surroundings. It was noon, the sun was shining, and it was the first day of June in the beautiful city of Paris, France. What could possibly go wrong? We rode by elevator to a double room on the upper floor to await the operation. My roommate was a handsome elderly gentleman by the name of Monsieur Fleurin. He spoke English and was in his late 60s. His wife was visiting him. Her father had been an American who had come to France as a soldier during World War I and stayed. Her English was excellent. She immediately tried to reassure me and comfort my frightened wife. Madame and Monsieur Fleem were exceedingly handsome people and gracious to us frightened foreigners. It was about noon and, after a flurry of activity, everything became calm. The bed I was given had no pillow, so Beverly made a roll of sheets to support my head. This was the beginning of the wait for the surgery, and the acute pain was gradually increasing. Jolts of stabbing, throbbing pain spread out into my torso. They took my breath away. The doctors told me to lie as still as possible, so as not to provoke the leaking hydrochloric acid and other juices that were digesting my insides. At that time, what I did not know was that on weekends, Parisian hospitals are understaffed. Most doctors vacation on the coast of France or in the country. I later learned that there was only one surgeon on duty in the entire hospital complex. Only he could operate at 3/4, only he could authorize any kind of medication. I never saw the surgeon that day, and since nurses in France have no authority to give medication, they were powerless to do anything for my increasingly grave condition. In the emergency room they had inserted the large rubber tube through my nose and down into my stomach to suction out digestive fluids. It was very difficult to talk and my mouth became very dry. 3/4 my mouth tasted like rubber. I wasn't allowed to drink anything to relieve the dryness. The pain in the center of my abdomen grew worse. The torment radiated out into my chest and down to the pelvis. Staying curled in a fetal position felt like the only way to keep the fire from radiating farther out into my extremities. Tears ran down my cheeks from the pain. The only sound I could make was an occasional low moan like an animal. Whenever I tried to talk, it agitated my abdomen and magnified the pain. It was best to lie perfectly still and focus on trying to breathe as quietly as possible. Minutes stretched into hours. No doctor came. Whenever a nurse entered the room, I begged for morphine. There was nothing they could do. When they ignored my pleas, I asked Monsieur Fleem to beg for me. I told the nurses that I was dying and I had Monsieur Fleem do the same. In the middle of the afternoon, the nurse said she would contact a doctor to see what they could do and gave me an injection of a stomach relaxant. It had no effect whatsoever. Every time Beverly or I asked the nurses about the operation, they said it would be done within the hour. By early afternoon, the relief from the morphine I had been given at the hotel had worn off completely. The fiery pain grew steadily worse. My stomach felt like it was full of burning coals. Hot flashes of intense pain shot into my arms and legs. I kept repeating in French that I was dying and begged for morphine over and over again. I kept thinking that I should be unconscious because of my condition. Nothing in my life had prepared me for this intense agony. Why didn't I black out? What had I ever done to deserve this? The nurse became increasingly impatient with our questions and pleas. Beverly was told that if she didn't stop her demands, she would be put out of the room. My poor beautiful wife could do nothing for me, and she couldn't get anyone to lift a finger to help me. She was acutely aware that she was losing me, and there was nothing she could do about it in spite of all her pleas. In hindsight, I realized that this woeful lack of attention resulted not from malice, but rather from bureaucratic ineptitude and indifference. I also realized that because I did not express the agony I was experiencing more dramatically, the staff didn't realize the full extent of my crisis. My whole life had been one of self-sufficient stoicism. I believed I didn't need anyone's help. I could handle anything. I could do this, I thought. In my extreme pain, seconds seemed like minutes and minutes seemed like hours. Minute by minute, second by second, the time passed into hours. By 8 o'clock that evening, the pain had become totally unbearable. I'd been in the same bed, in the same position, in the same room since noon without ever seeing a doctor. The pain didn't come and go in waves anymore, it just got worse and worse. The hydrochloric acid leaking from my stomach was spreading throughout my abdominal cavity and literally eating me up from the inside. The searing torment was gaining strength and I was getting weaker. Breathing was almost impossible. I tried to pour every bit of energy into inhaling and exhaling to stay alive. It was vividly clear to me that if I failed to breathe, it would be the end of my life. Period. I was so weakened from the ordeal, I knew there was very little strength left in me. I kept thinking, this is not how it's supposed to end. I was fading away in a Paris hospital and they were indifferent to my agony. Why didn't they care? What would happen to my wife, my two children, my paintings, my house, my gardens, all the things I cared about? I was 38 years old and just beginning to achieve some fame as an artist. Had all my work and struggle come to this? I had grown so frail that I could hardly lift my head or speak. Beverly looked drained, totally emotionally exhausted. I didn't want to tell her that I knew the end was near. I told her I couldn't hold on much longer. It had gotten very dark outside the window of the Bay Hospital room. I was later told by American doctors back in the United States that from the time of the perforation, my life expectancy was about 5 hours. The condition I had was similar to a burst appendix. Sometime around 9 o'clock, one of the nurses came into the room. She said the doctor had gone home and the operation couldn't be performed until the next morning. I knew I wouldn't survive until then. 10 hours had now passed since the hole in my stomach erupted. I had fought as long and as hard as I could to stay alive. I had nothing left. It was impossible to muster the strength to breathe anymore. I knew I was dying now. I knew that dying was the only way out of this world of pain. To die was the easiest thing in the world. All I would have to do was stop fighting to breathe in, breathe out. I turned to Beverly, who had been crying for hours, and I had never seen her look so distressed. Fighting against the flood of tears, I told her that I loved her very much. I told her it was over. We said our goodbyes to each other. I didn't have the courage or strength to say more. She got up from her chair next to the bed and put her arms around me. She kissed me and told me that she loved me and she would always love me, and then she said goodbye. She sat back down and cried from the core of her being, saying to myself, "Let it end now." I closed my eyes. The last thing I saw was Beverly's throbbing shoulders and her hands pressed over her eyes as I went into oblivion. I knew that what would happen next would be the end of any kind of consciousness or existence. I knew that to be true. The idea of any kind of life after death never entered my mind because I didn't believe in that kind of thing. I knew for certain that there was no such thing as life after death. Only simple-minded people believed in that sort of thing. I didn't believe in God, or heaven, or hell, or any other fairy tales. I drifted into darkness, asleep into annihilation was standing up. I opened my eyes to see why I was standing up. I was between the two hospital beds in the hospital room. This wasn't right. Why was I alive? I had wanted oblivion, escape from the all-consuming, unbearable pain. Could this be a dream? I kept thinking, this has got to be a dream. But I knew that it wasn't. I was aware that I felt more alert, more aware, and more alive than I had ever felt in my entire life. All my senses were extremely vivid. Everything around and in me was alive. The linoleum tiles on the floor were slick and cool, and my bare feet felt moist and clammy against them. The bright light of the room illuminated every detail in crystal clarity. The mix of odors of stale urine, sweat, residue of bleach from the sheet, and enamel paint filled my nostrils. The sounds of my breathing and the blood rushing through my veins hummed in my ears. The surface of my skin tingled with the sensations of air moving across it. My mouth tasted stale and dry. How bizarre to feel all of my senses heightened and alert, as if I had just been born. Thoughts raced through my mind. This is no dream. I am more alive than I have ever been. This is too real. I squeezed my fists and was amazed how much I was feeling in my hands just by making a fist. I could feel the bones in my hands, the muscles expand and contract, skin pressed against skin. I touched my body with my hands in several places and everything was intact, alive. My head, shoulders, arms, abdomen, and thighs were all intact. I pinched myself and it hurt. I was aware of the problem in my stomach, but it was not as severe as before. It was more of a memory of the pain. I was profoundly aware of my situation and of the necessity of having an operation as soon as possible. In every respect, I was more alive than I had ever been in my life. I looked at my roommate, Monsieur Fleem, and his eyes were half closed. I turned and looked at Beverly sitting in the chair next to my bed. She was motionless, staring at the floor. She looked physically exhausted and emotionally drained. I spoke to her, but she didn't seem to hear. She sat absolutely motionless. I gave up trying to talk to her for the moment because something between us caught my attention. There was an object in the bed under the sheet. As I bent over to look at the face of the body in the bed, I was horrified to see the resemblance that it had to my own face. It was impossible that that thing could be me because I was standing over it and looking at it. I was looking down at a facsimile of my hands, arms, torso, legs, and feet under the sheet. It looked like my face, but it looked so meaningless, like a husk, empty and lifeless. I was standing the next to the bed and staring at the object in the bed. Everything that was me, my consciousness and physical being, was standing next to the bed. No, it wasn't me lying in the bed. It was just a thing that didn't have any importance to me. It may as well have been a slab of meat in the supermarket. The impossibility of the situation set my mind reeling. It occurred to me that I must have gone crazy. Somehow I had split my being into two parts. I was schizophrenic, completely mad, delusional. Yet I had never felt more alert and conscious. I wanted desperately to get through to Beverly, and I started yelling for her to say something, but she remained frozen in the chair next to the bed. I screamed and raged at her, but she just ignored me. No matter how loudly I yelled or cursed at her, there was no reaction. Her eyes didn't even blink. It was impossible that she couldn't hear me screaming. I turned around to Monsieur Fleem in the bed behind me. I bent over him and yelled inches from his face, "Why are you ignoring me?" He looked right through me as though I were not even there. I could see the droplets of spittle hitting his face as I screamed at him. He stared right through me as if I were invisible. Nothing worked the way it was supposed to. I became increasingly upset as anger, fear, and confusion filled me. The hospital room was brightly lit. Everything was vividly clear. All of the details of the room were extremely sharp and distinct. Every nuance in the linoleum floor, every bump in the paint on the steel bed was magnified. I had never viewed the world with such clarity and exactness. Everything was in such extreme focus that it was overwhelming. My sense of taste and touch and temperature were exploding. The taste in my mouth was revolting because it was so overpowering. What's happening to me? This is so real. But how can this be? Maybe, I thought, they had built a wax replica of me while I was unconscious. They could have made a quick drying mold of my face and put it on a dummy while I was out and put it in the bed. But why would they do that? Is this some kind of test to see how I would react? This doesn't make any sense. How else could this happen? Off in the distance, outside the room in the hall, I heard voices calling me. Howard, Howard. They were calling. They were pleasant voices, male and female, young and old, calling me in English. None of the hospital staff spoke English so clearly, three-quarters they couldn't pronounce the name Howard very well. I was hopelessly confused. Beverly and Monsieur Fleem didn't seem to hear them. I asked who they were and what they wanted. Come out here, they said. Let's go, hurry up. We've been waiting for you for a long time. I can't, I said. I'm sick. Something or TMS the matter with three-quarters, something's wrong in here. I need an operation. I am very sick. We can get you fixed up, they said. If you hurry up. Don't you want to get better? Don't you want help? I was in an unknown hospital in a foreign country, in an extremely bizarre situation, and I was afraid of those people calling me. They were irritated by my questions, which were only attempts to find out who they were. The hallway looked strange as I moved closer to the door. I had a feeling that if I left the room, it might be impossible to get back in. But I couldn't communicate with my wife and I couldn't communicate with my roommate. The voices continued to say, "We can't help you if you don't come out here." After more unanswered questions, I assumed they must be here to take me to my operation. Who else could they be? I decided to follow them rather than remain in a room where everyone ignored me. After all, I needed surgery. I stepped out into the hall, full of anxiety. The area seemed to be light but very hazy, like a television screen with terrible reception. I couldn't make out any details. It was like being in a plane passing through thick clouds. The people were off in the distance and I couldn't see them very clearly. But I could tell that they were male and female, tall and short, old and young adults. Their clothes were grey and they were pale. As I tried to get close to them to identify them, they quickly withdrew deeper into the fog. So I had to follow farther and farther into the thick atmosphere. I could never get closer to them than 10 feet. I had lots of questions. Who were they? What did they want? Where did they want me to go? What was the matter with my wife? How could this be real? They wouldn't answer anything. Their only response was to insist that I hurry up and follow them. They told me repeatedly that my problems were meaningless and unnecessary. In emotional distress, I followed them, shuffling along in my bare feet with the memory of the pain in my belly, feeling very much alive. I was moist with perspiration, quite confused, but not at all tired. I knew that I had a problem that must be operated on right away. They appeared to be my only hope. Every time I hesitated, they demanded that I keep up. They continued to repeat the promise that if I followed them, my troubles would end. We walked on, and my repeated inquiries were rebuffed. They insisted on hurrying to get to our destination. During the journey, I attempted to count how many of these people there were and figure out something about their individual identities, but I couldn't. The fog thickened as we went on, and it became gradually darker. They moved around me and their numbers seemed to be increasing. I was confused about the direction we were taking. I knew that we had been traveling for miles, but I had the strange ability to occasionally look back and see through the doorway of the hospital room, although the door was getting smaller and smaller. That body was still there, lying motionless on the bed. Beverly was sitting there as frozen as she had been when this surreal experience first began. It seemed many miles away, but I could still see it off in the distance.